This is an interview with Anne Diefenbacher-Krall. Today is January 22nd, 2014, and this is Adam Chile doing the interview. So, just to get us started off, I'm wondering if you can tell me how you got interested in studying climate.
I am a botanist, and I was interested in botanical conservation.
Mm-hmm.
I came to the Institute through George Jacobson as my advisor for my master's. I was looking for a project where I could, you know, get my hands dirty in botanical conservation, and he came up with a project for the Maine Coast Heritage Trust for a unique piece of property that they had in down East Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And what we wanted to do was figure out the land use history and see if we could figure out how it was a grassland, and it's not an area where grasslands are common.
Hmm.
So if we could figure out how it became a grassland and how it has been maintained as a grassland, which required using paleoecological techniques.
Hmm.
And then from there I became involved in other projects with the Institute and took on a more climate-related direction, but still using some of the same tools.
I see. So you did further collaborative work with George Jacobson?
He was my advisor for my master's and my doctorate. And then when he retired, I basically took over his lab as a research scientist.
Mm-hmm. So around what time was that?
I finished my doctorate in 1998.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was, so I came on board 6 years before that as a student.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of research did you do with other faculty members in the Institute?
I've been involved in reconstructing the late glacial time period, both climate-wise using chironomids, which are a type of insect, and plant remains for the time periods right at the end of the Ice Age, where there was a lot of change going on.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to refine the timing of those changes and the magnitude of the changes. I've worked in northern Maine with hailborns.
Mm-hmm.
I've done work in New Zealand with George Denton, who was a postdoctoral mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Marcus Vandergoes, who came from New Zealand and is now back in New Zealand, but was here for several years as a postdoc, and still has an affiliation with the Institute. Mostly them, and Brenda Hall somewhat. We've been co-advising a student
mm-hmm.
on a project in actually not too far from here.
I wonder if you can walk me through the day-to-day work that you did with Hal Borns in northern Maine. What parts, what research project did you work on together, and what parts did you take on, and what parts did he do?
We did a multi-proxy study of conditions around the Aremna ice cap that seems to have readvanced during the Younger Dryas time. And Hale did geologic field work. I went up with him, and we hired a backhoe and dug some holes, and he
mm-hmm.
took some samples out. I did a lake level reconstruction from several lakes that surrounded the ice cap. And also had a graduate student who was doing an investigation of chironomid remains, which are a really highly resolved proxy for temperature. You can count, identify and count the chironomids at any given point in time, and using a mathematical formula that's been developed, convert them to temperature.
Chironomids?
Yeah. Non-flighted midges. They spend most of their life cycle living as larvae in lake mud, so little worms.
And they contain traces of
No, it's the different species have different ecological preferences. So the head capsules on them are made of chitin, which is what beetle shells are made out of.
Mm-hmm.
Preserves really, really well. I've found them 20,000 years old that are in absolutely pristine condition. So if we can identify them to genus, usually, occasionally to species, and then we, based on modern studies of which bugs live where, we can, you know, which those studies are used to calibrate them.
Indeed. So your work is yet another piece of evidence to show that climate can be studied from a lot of different angles.
Mm. Yeah, so we combine, in that study we combined the bug study with Hale's geological research, and we did a lake level study which uses changes in the sediment composition, as well as seeds of aquatic plants which have different water depths at which they live. So we reconstructed the water depths, which is a proxy for, it's not strictly just precipitation, it's precipitation and temperature combined
mm-hmm.
affect how deep the water is at any given point in time. And then a student was an honor student, Chris Sales, who was working with Jim Fastuck, modeled Hale's ice sheet. And so we had this computer model to compare with the physical data that we were coming up with.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still working on, it's written, but we're still working on getting them published.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And then I've worked with Hale on just helping him core lakes for studies of where the ice edge was at different points in time. So we've cored some lakes down east.
Okay, so walk me through that. You take a core from the bottom of a lake,
mm-hmm.
and contained in that core is evidence of where the...
If you can get a basal date, so that's the date at which the date of the bottom sediment, so when the lake began collecting sediment,
mm-hmm.
that tells you when the ice had retreated back over it. So when it was able to start collecting organic material.
Okay, so there would be a gap in a core that you would actually be able to identify, right?
Well, the core would bottom out. Most of the lakes would have been scraped pretty clean
uh-huh.
by the glacier. So when they started collecting organic material, that's like a minimum date. Like the ice had been gone by this date, may have been gone before that, and simply didn't accumulate enough organic material to date. We do occasionally find one where we'll get a date that we know is ridiculously old, and there is some possibility for older carbon being down there as well.
Fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about the work you did with George Denton in New Zealand?
Yeah, George is interested in New Zealand and the glacial changes there at the end of the Ice Age and even before that. It's on the total opposite side of the world from where we are. And if we can figure out the geographic extent of different climate events, then you can, it gives you evidence towards what were the causes of them. For example, something that only affected New England is going to have a very different cause than something that was a global event. So we were looking at the end of the Ice Age to figure, again, the timing and magnitude of the changes. George got funding for us through the Comer Science and Education Foundation, which
mm-hmm.
was founded by Gary Comer, who founded the Land's End clothing
mm-hmm.
Shops. So Marcus Vandergoes from New Zealand and I served as postdocs, and we used primarily chironomids and also pollen
mm-hmm.
to reconstruct vegetation and temperature at different sites on the Southern Alps.
Hmm. So you've described that research. I'm wondering if you can tell me about how you felt doing that. And there you were working in what may seem to many common Americans like a pretty exotic location.
It was really, really cool.
Yeah.
If you've ever watched the Lord of the Rings movies and seen the scenery as they fly over the mountains, well, I did that. You know, we flew in, we had to do, there was very little chronometric research, so we had to calibrate the modern books. So we went to lakes at different altitudes up and down both the east and west sides of the mountains. And access to those sites was, you know, there wasn't roads to a lot of them. So we would hire a helicopter, and we would fly in the morning, and we'd have them drop us off at one lake. And we'd spend the day hiking the ridge and going down either side to the various lakes. And we had a little inflatable rubber boat, and we'd just float out to the middle of the lake and take a mud sample and take some chemical and physical measurements and then pack it all up and go to the next lake.
Yeah.
But it was awesome. I mean, a lot of times we were places where you'd wonder, had any human ever been there before? And then, of course, you'd find like a broken buckle of a backpack and know that, well, I guess somebody was here.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really awesome.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're hiking all day long to get to the research site, are you all business during that time, or are you enjoying the hike?
No, it's fun.
Yeah.
You would do it for fun. So it's like you feel like you're getting away with something because
yeah.
It's like, ooh, here we are having this great time, and you know, we're getting paid for it. The National Science Foundation is supporting us to do this, or whoever. But for like 2 days of field work can equal, you know, if you take a long core from a lake, you can be in the lab for 3 years working on that. So that's a small part of it. I'm much more likely to be in the lab on a microscope. And I have a lot of undergraduate students who've worked with me over the years to help in sample preparation, and they'll sit and work for hours at a time on a dissecting microscope prepping these bug samples for us.
Mm-hmm. Walk me through your day-to-day lab work.
Oh, it depends on the project. If we're looking at plant macrofossils, we'll take mud samples and soak them overnight in a mild-based solution, sieve them, and then spend the day under dissecting microscope identifying the individual seeds and counting them. And they're very beautiful when you look at them at that scale. When we bring back fresh cores, we'll spend any number of days just describing them, sampling them, doing loss on ignition, which is burning samples to find out organic content, subsampling them, so we'll be slicing them up and putting samples for pollen in little vials and samples for chironomids in other little vials and samples for this, that, and the other thing in little baggies. And, you know, you can spend a day just deconstructing the core.
I imagine that takes special tools.
It's more like kitchen work, because you're using little spatulas.
I'm envisioning what? You have this cylindrical core, and you're cutting out small slivers of it.
Well, most of the time we extrude the core in the field, so you've got what looks like a tube of dirt, but it's just the dirt, so we've already removed it from the tube.
Mm-hmm.
And then we scrape it to clean off, you know, when you push the tube in, it smears material.
Mm-hmm.
So you clean off the outside where you'll have contaminated material, usually slice it and work from the inside of it so you know it's pristine and nothing has shifted.
Oh, you'll cut it in half.
Exactly. And, you know, if we can, we'll archive half of it. But generally, we want more mud than we've got. Because we've also started doing some lipid analysis, which looks at cell membranes formed by bacteria. and the long chain molecules in them have a different configuration depending on what temperature they formed at.
Mm-hmm.
So we're calibrating them as a possible temperature proxy as well. So between all these different types of sampling, you know, we run out of mud routinely. So when we go to take cores, we'll try to take multiples in the same spot, and then you have to figure out how to match them up. But for the insect remains, it's really time consuming, and except for the microscopes, it's pretty low tech. I mean, our most important tool is our own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
We'll sieve those samples through a small mesh, and we took a baby bottle and cut the bottom of it off, and then threw the nipple away and put a piece of mesh there. And so we just sieve through that, and it doesn't get any lower tech than that.
Mm-hmm.
And then sit at a dissecting scope, and this is the part that the undergrads do because it is mind-numbingly tedious. You pick through the mud. I mean, any little piece of junk, you got to pick it up and flip it over to see if one of these bugheads is hiding under it, because you have to get all of them.
Huh.
If you miss some, you might miss them systematically, like you might miss all of some size or all of some color, and then your whole species assemblage, your results will be all thrown off by that.
Hmm.
So they are trained for weeks, and everything they do, we check until they get to the point where they're not missing any at all. And so they pick up each bug with a tweezers, and then they have to turn to another microscope because these things are so small. They're like dust size. They're like smaller than flecks of pepper, and you wouldn't be able to see. And they're very pale in color. They're like a light amber.
Mm-hmm.
So they're invisible to your naked eye. So you have to get it onto the glass slide. So you turn to the other microscope where you have your glass slide. You have to look and make sure you actually get it on there. And I'm really bad at it. I mean, I shred them and mangle them. The students are much better than I am. I had one student who would get them all lined up in perfect rows. And it was amazing. I don't know how
mm-hmm.
he did it.
Hmm.
And then those are... once they're dry, they're sealed, and then we go to a compound microscope
mm.
and look at each one and identify it.
Mm. What was the most difficult field trip you've been on?
I don't like coring in the winter in Maine through the ice, which logistically it's easier to set up than, you know, what we do in the summer is we construct a raft. It's basically a sheet of plywood, which we bungee to a couple of canoes, and then you got to get it anchored so it can't move at all while you're working. And if you drop something, you lose it, goes
mm-hmm.
in the water. And there's bugs, and there's, you know, sunburn, and but I much prefer that to working in the winter. So we went on to Moulton Pond, which is in Dedham, which is just south of here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those winters where it just didn't freeze up until really late.
Mm-hmm.
So we must have gone down there three times and it wasn't until March when the ice was actually thick enough. So we, you know, go down and punch a bunch of holes in the ice and decide, well, is this thick enough? Because you're not simply standing on the ice. You've got a whole bunch of people clustered together around the hole. And sometimes we'll set up a tripod with a winch, and we're pulling up the corer, and if it's stuck in the mud, it's quite a lot of force. So you're actually pulling down the ice. So you need really good ice.
Yeah.
You need, like, pickup truck quality ice, not, like, just walk across the ice.
Right.
And then if it's like that day, it was a nice warm day. I mean, it was above freezing. It was a nice day to be out there, except when it's above freezing, you get a layer of water on top of the ice, and that layer of water is 32 degrees.
Hmm.
And you're climbing around, and you're basically wallowing in it. So
mm-hmm.
there's no help for it. You're just soaked from head to toe, and it's just miserable. And if it's any colder than that, anything you pull out of the lake, your gear instantly freezes up.
Mm-hmm. But most of your time is actually spent analyzing information.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who else have you worked with besides Hal and George Jacobson and George Denton?
Well, Jim Festook, indirectly through the student who was modeling with him. Any number of, you know, dozens of undergrad students, and some of the graduate students, especially Brenda Hall's students. Sean Burkle worked with us on the ice sheet modeling as well. Mm-hmm. I have a project now with Lisa Doner, who is at Plymouth State University in New Hampshire, and she's an alumni of the Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing a project in Iceland. Of course, Ron Davis was on both my master's and doctoral committees. And I've worked with him on things completely outside, like the Bog Boardwalk. I worked with him on the signage for that, the informational signs.
What did you do? What did the two of you do for that?
He did most of the writing, and we did the layout of those signs, and then revamped them a few years back when, you know, they just weathered.
Mm-hmm.
And so while we were reprinting, we updated some of the text on them.
I see.
Andrea Nurse, I've worked a great deal with for years on both professional projects, and we've done monitoring of rare plants for the New England Wildflower Society.
Mm-hmm.
Karen Mary's daughter is a... she's not affiliated with the university. She is a regular person who called up and said she was interested in climate change and could she volunteer. And she volunteered in my lab for 4 years, and she did everything. She did subsampling of cores, and she picked bugs, and she, when we were planning a field trip to New Zealand, she asked, you know, hey, if I pay my own way, can I come? I'm like, yeah, and she came to New Zealand, and she carried, you know, heavy pack for miles over the mountains and didn't complain once. She was just great.
So when you joined the Institute, well, you finished your doctorate in 1998. So really, that was just before Paul Majewski came,
mm-hmm.
and the Institute underwent a rather profound change.
Right.
How did you view the changes that took place around that time?
Well, you're right. It did have a huge impact in terms of the number of people at the Institute, but also the variety of people and the variety of disciplines that people were working in. So there's some logistical issues, like things like field trips, and when we had our annual seminars, and so there were just so many more people to accommodate, but... oh, I think it's cool because it really broadened the scope of the Institute and the scope of the questions that were being addressed. Moved up into a lot of more recent work, whereas prior to that, a lot of the work had focused on the late glacial time period.
What's an example of... studying scientists who are studying more recent periods?
Jasmine Saros does decadal scale studies of lake chemistry in the Rocky Mountains. All the folks who are working on ice cores, their studies can be you know, they can get annual scale records. And it depends on what they're looking at. They could be looking at something that was a few hundred to 1,000 years old, or, you know, something that was, you know, 100,000 year cycles. Hmm. You know, when a lot of the work was focused on Maine, we can only go back to the glacier, you know, to the, because the ice scraped us clean. But if you go down into the depths of ice cores, you know, some of them are 2 miles long. I mean, you're going hundreds of thousands of years.
Mm, yeah. So would you say then the scope of inquiry is broadened at both ends?
Oh, very much so. And, you know, people like Marcy Sorg, who joined more recently and is looking at climate and health questions and, you know, impact of climate change on crime scenes. Yeah, it's just moving into more modern issues and probably a lot more applied mm-hmm. issues.
Mm-hmm. What do you think has been the Institute's greatest contribution to our understanding of climate?
I wouldn't venture to say just one thing.
What would you say that what the Institute maybe is best known for, the contribution?
Oh my, there's lots and lots. You know, Terry Hughes's work on Antarctic ice sheet dynamics, and which way predates me, and the ice core work, and the, you know, the more recent stuff, such as Brenda Hall is dating boulders, like how long boulders have been exposed to the sun, so she can find out when they were last rolled over by glacial ice.
Hmm.
And it's letting us really pinpoint climate events that, using the geological methods before that, you could never have gotten as fine detail chronologically of when things happened. What's always impressed me the most is looking over even rather short timescales, how much change there's been and how constant change is. So if we're, you know, if people are concerned about global warming and, you know, a modern phenomenon, but in the context of, like, even the past 10,000 years, we've had changes bigger and frequent, which is not to minimize by any means the current global warming issues.
Mm-hmm.
But just that change is the norm.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. It seems to me that outside the scientific community, the human role in climate change is still very much up for debate. And I'm wondering if you could speculate as to why that might be the case.
Outside the scientific community, because within the scientific community, it's pretty much well understood.
Right.
I don't really know. I think a lot of people have a hard time understanding the big impacts we can have by what seem like relatively small activities. One thing that really impressed me about working in New Zealand was the fact that people have only been there for like 1,000 years. The Maori people arrived there about 1,000 years ago. Before that, no humans. But in that, what in the context of all of, you know, since we evolved from our hominid ancestors, that's a teeny little fraction of time. And it was a very small population of people, and they completely changed the ecology of the North and South Island, and, you know, devastatingly in a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. Or if you look at the extinction of the megafauna and, you know, the debate about did human hunters kill them off or not. And you're looking at, you know, a small population of humans moving into the Americas and how quickly mammoths and the mastodons and the great short-faced bear and the giant ground sloth disappeared. And, you know, these are folks who are hunting with bows and arrows. So I think people have a hard time accepting that we can make such huge impacts with just a few of us. Mm-hmm. And then, when you're talking about it's changing the global climate. And, you know, how can I be doing that just by driving my car here and back again?
What do you think is required to address the problem?
Just continued education and I don't know how you combat like the radio talk hosts who will just pan any scientific information that comes out and choose not to believe it and then loudly broadcast their belief to their listeners. Education. Starting in the grade schools. Mm-hmm. It would be great if we had a more scientifically literate society.
Well, that's all the questions I have. But before we conclude the interview, I do want to give you a chance to maybe add something that I didn't think to ask you about.
I think for me the coolest thing about working with the Institute is we talk a lot, and people write all kinds of proposals about interdisciplinary study, but in the Institute it's the norm. I mean, you work with historians or, Dave Sanger, archaeology, I did some work with him, and geologists, and what I've observed in other disciplines is that it's really very difficult to pull together an interdisciplinary team, but just the way the Institute was originally set up and the way it's interacted over the years with, our annual seminars and our fall field trips where everyone gets to know each other and everyone gets to know each other's works. It's very, very easy. I mean, it's just the norm to do that type of project, and it's very powerful.
What do you think are the administrative hurdles to doing interdisciplinary research in other departments? Or are there any administrative hurdles?
Yeah, I don't know that they're administrative. They may simply be I hesitate to say cultural, but if you work within a certain discipline and all of your interactions are within that discipline, mm-hmm. and you go to conferences and everyone there is working in the same discipline, you're going to be really well versed in that discipline. But the idea of working with people outside of it, you may not know what, if you're a forester, you may not know what people in geology do and what types of evidence they can come up with that would be relevant to your questions. I think it's more a matter of that we come to understand something about what the other disciplines can contribute and the methods they use, and, we're over in Sawyer and in Bryant, people are in and out of each other's labs, and you know, you just see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you once again for participating in this interview.
Well, good luck with the project.
Thanks.